All right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic one more time on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. Coming at you live once again. And, from this very center of the universe. And that is Clear Creek County, Colorado, downtown Idaho Springs. And wonderful day up here. What do you think, Sonny?
It's gorgeous. I wonder where the snow is.
That we'd be getting a lot of sun here soon. All right, it'll be a little punny there. But no, it's been very dry. Windy as all get out, but very dry moisture-wise. And the snow level content is very low for the entire state.
Right. I've been watering my lawn in Denver.
Yeah. Same here. You know, I don't have a lawn, but just every once in a while, you still have to put moisture on.
That's right.
You know, for the plants, even the ones that are hardy and live up here, too.
Right.
So, So, welcome. And, this is the Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. I just want to, again, remind our listening audience of that. And with me is Sonny Weber. And she has written, the last book was Beyond Flight or Fight. And I want to talk about Sonny here and to her about her latest work and one up and coming as well. Before we do that, I want to thank all our sponsors, because without sponsors, community radio like this, not possible. Special shout out to the businesses in Georgetown jumping on board here too, and getting a lot of events happening in Georgetown all the time. So head on up there. I am sponsoring, bringing you this next hour, and if you can learn more about my work, Sisyphus Wins, at jerryfabianic.com. And in the meantime, though, we want to talk to Sonny Weber, who has about 25 years of experience in pet rescue, humane education, shelter and sanctuary work, service and therapy dog training, temperament testing, behavior evaluation, obedience competition, fostering, pet medical care, horse ground training, and has authored articles and books in several fields. For over 20 years, Sonny has offered in-home consultations for problematic pet behavior diagnosis and management. She diplomatically addresses pet owner conflicts with practical, realistic evaluation and compassionate counseling through her Manners for Mutts and Kits behavior business. And dovetailing with her expertise and passion, Sonny specializes in fearful animals. She has personally rehabilitated and rehomed dogs, cats, and horses. Sonny has mentored other people who have saved more pet lives and consults with rescues, shelters, and sanctuaries. Welcome again. You were here about a year or so ago?
Just about a year ago, right.
Yeah. And we were talking about your work, Beyond Flight and Fight. Let's start with that one, just to kind of review a little bit, to get people up to speed, because to me, that was an awesome work there, and I just learned so much of, it was basically like psychotherapy for dogs and cats and so forth, but talk about that work, Sonny.
Well, thanks for having me back again, Jerry. It's always good to see you. Always good to be in the mountains. Yeah. But also, that book I wrote primarily, it's called Beyond Flight or Fight, A Compassionate Guide for Working with Fearful Dogs. It began as a book for dogs, cats, and horses, but I decided to narrow the focus, although most of the techniques that we cite in that book apply to all large brain social animals. The brain chemistry is the same in all those animals, and the approaches to fear stimuli are pretty much the same. So that book was really important to me because there are so many, particularly dogs, that are being euthanized because of fear issues, because rescues and shelters don't have the resources or the time to work with these animals, and they take a lot of time. Despite what you may see on TV or in little clips on the internet, it takes a long time to turn around a fearful dog. I work a lot with puppy mill dogs who've never been socialized. I've worked with feral dogs who've never been even handled at all. And the same goes with horses. And it takes a long, long time to build up their trust. It takes even longer if they've been mistreated in the past by humans. So you have to approach the conditioning that they have received. So for me, that book was a labor of love because I worked with animals and there was really nothing to help me. And I just kind of learned by the seat of my pants and networking with other people who were doing what I did. When I started in the animal welfare business, it was so long ago, there weren't titles. There weren't schools. There was no way to really get information except sharing it with other people and networking. And we all started in our backyards, you know, bringing these animals in and working with them and then rehoming them. And so I've worked with rescues, sanctuaries, and shelters, all three different, very different organizations, which I spell out in the book and what are the differences between them. And everybody's on the same page trying to save lives. Mm-hmm. And the way to save dog lives is to educate people. And that's what I decided to do, was to take all those years of work, trial and error, things that worked, things that didn't work, and put them in a book so that more people could come up behind me and learn how to help more animals in a human world. Because it's like putting you on Mars and into a house with a Martian and say, okay, learn their culture, learn their language, learn their way of life, mm-hmm. without really knowing where to start. And so whatever makes it easier for dogs and their people, and the whole goal is to get them into homes and then keep them there. Because fearful dogs are also the most rejected and the most euthanized animal personality type out there. And so the whole goal is to save these lives and get them in homes, but more importantly, keep them in those homes. Because a lot of times people get them, they feel sorry for the cute little cowering dog in the corner of the kennel in the shelter, and they say, oh, I want to take that baby home and teach him love. Well, it's not that easy with a lot of them.
Right.
And especially puppy mill dogs. And so once you get a dog like that home, you quickly run out of resources. Even I did. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be thinking out of the box and just doing whatever works for that animal. And there's really no seat of the pants type book out there until I decided to write mine. And mm-hmm. some of the stuff in there is stuff I tried that's really kind of far out there, but it worked with a lot of animals. And if it didn't work, then I didn't use it. But to think that you can use one technique like clicker training, or one technique like pop and jerk training, or one technique of any sort, and have it work 100% of the time on 100% of the animals, it just isn't like that. You need to have an entire repertoire of knowledge that you can pull from and experiment and see what works. And dogs, bless their hearts, are so forgiving that if you screw up and you decide to change course and try something else, they generally will come along.
How does one, let's say you pick up and you get that cowering little pup or whatever from the shelter with best of intentions, how do you learn about the dog's past without having been given a biography of some sort by its behaviors? That maybe it's fearful of men's voices, for example, or it doesn't like to be around little children or whatever it is. Is there ways, telltale signs, that the animals will communicate to us what their fears are?
Well, fear comes about in a couple different ways. A lot of people will say, oh, I adopted this dog that was abused because she's so afraid of men or children, like you say. And that may not be the case. It may be that this dog's never been around men, never been around children. And so it's a novel stimuli, and they don't know how to process it. It could be that, yeah, maybe they were abused by someone and they have this memory. So fear comes about genetically and experientially.
Okay. Same with humans.
Oh, exactly. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. The brain structure, the stress hormones, everything is exactly the same. And so what I tell people who take on these animals, and oftentimes, especially with animals that come from shelters, we don't always know their history. A lot of times people will bring in an animal and relinquish it, and they won't tell us the truth. They won't say, you know, my dog is child aggressive, and I'm getting rid of him because I have a kid now. Mm-hmm. I started dating a person who has a child, and this dog is freaking out, so we got to get rid of the dog. Mm-hmm. It's a little more difficult to get rid of the kid.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, dogs pay the price. But what I tell people in that situation is, number one, my goal is to keep the dog in the home and teach them everything I possibly can teach them so that that dog can stay with them, help the people understand. But it's not so important what the actual past is with the animal. Animals live in the present. They're going to have memories. They're going to have fear memories. Some of them are huge. Some of them are not that huge. So you will have to discover as you go along working with the dog and getting to know it, what are the fear triggers? How big are those fear triggers? And what is the fear reaction? How big is the fear reaction? As you work with that animal to desensitize it to the fear that stimuli that it sets it off, or you habituate it to some degree, maybe they'll never totally overcome that fear, but you can habituate them to be able to be closer to that fear stimuli or have that fear stimuli be a little less, you know, reactionary. And so when you're working with the animal, what you want to start looking at is the startle response. Because if the animal goes into a limbic, knee-jerk, primitive, get-me-out-of-here reaction, you never want to put a dog that far over threshold. We call it over threshold, when the dog just snaps into panic.
Right.
You want to make sure that you're never putting that intense of a situation together, that you the dog cannot think through how it can process that fear. So when you start working with a dog and you discover fear triggers, you want to slowly desensitize and habituate. I go over all this in the book. Depending on what that fear stimuli is, it can be distance, it can be loudness or quietness, it can be a smaller exposure to that stimuli so that you can gradually increase more. But as far as the history goes, you're not going to know what it is nine times out of ten. So you've got to take that dog, where is that dog now, and how can you get that dog more comfortable over a period of time? And because they do live in the moment, and they will have their fear memories, but they live in the moment. They don't sit around and dwell on the past like people do. They will move forward mentally and cognitively so much better than people do. Especially if they are constantly being reinforced with positive reinforcement that will show them that A, that fear trigger isn't so bad, and B, there are ways to deal with this fear, and I'm going to teach you how to self-care so that you don't need to react to this fear stimuli the way you always have in the past.
And it seems then that on part of the human, I hate to say owner or anything like that, it kind of gets in, you know, but at any rate, the person, the human being who's in charge, one is patience, and the other is developing that sense of trust with the animal. Right there.
Right.
You'll never allow him or her to be in a situation, and if you see them in there, to de-escalate that in some way.
Right.
Maybe it's the vacuum cleaner.
Right.
Okay. Or the doorbell or whatever it is. And it's okay. How do you do that sort of thing? So it seems to be that, you know, that seems like a simple thing, but it's huge.
Right, it's huge. Trust is everything. Everything. If an animal can't trust you, you're not going to make any headway at all. And that animal's life will be continuously one of anxiety and fear. The animals need a lot of routine. They need a lot of steadiness, and you have to be very consistent. And to build that trust, if you ever betray the trust, that animal is going to remember that. And building trust is huge with animals, just like it is with people, but even more so, because they deal with a much simpler cognitive level. Humans can say, oh, yes, well, my spouse, you know, betrayed me with another woman, but he had his reasons, and we've worked it out with the counselor, and now we're still together. You betray a dog's trust, and he's going to remember that. And it's going to be much, much harder to build any sort of lasting relationship unless that dog can 100% trust you all the time.
Yeah, and that is something that the dog will remember. So if you raise your hand and swat it, it's going to remember.
Well, the bad thing about that is it's going to associate your hand with pain, which is the last thing you want, is a dog to associate your hands with anything that is negative.
Interesting.
Because you've got to use your hands constantly with an animal.
Okay.
And they're going to associate things that we don't necessarily think of. And hands are huge tools working with fearful animals. So you never ever want to use your hands or your feet or even direct eye contact, facial expressions in the sort of way that is going to place fear in an animal, because they are going to read that before you even know you're broadcasting mm-hmm. any sort of a communication to that animal. They're total body readers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want to get into that, Sonny, about the body reading itself. It's not only vis-a-vis the animal and the human, but also within animals themselves and how they read each other too. You know, because body language is we pick up it. It's an unconscious thing on our part.
Right.
You know, someone comes up and has a smile on their face and right. their shoulders are down, you know. But, you know, if there's a tight grin, that's a whole different thing as opposed to a smile. And we subconsciously get that right away. Mm-hmm. But animals depend on that, I think, even far more, because as you point out, they're not cognitive or rational as we are to say, okay, someone's in a situation here that helps explain why they're screaming, running down the street. Mm-hmm. You know, the house was on fire. Okay, I get it. The dog doesn't necessarily, you know, rationalize.
They're nonverbal animals, and they communicate with each other through body language, and they watch us. So if you are telling a dog to come to you, but you've got very aggressive body language, that dog's going to watch the body language and believe the body language, and that's why your dog won't come to you. Uh-huh. You know, why would anybody come to anybody to be punished?
Right.
And so the come command is the most important command of all, because you can get a dog out of danger. You never ever want to betray trust, because that dog will never come to you again, and that is a very important command. So the come command, for example, as I talk about in the book, needs to be a completely positive experience. For example, if the dog is doing something you don't want it to do, chewing on your shoe, or it's eating something questionable in the yard, you don't yell really meanly and authoritatively, come, get over here, you know, because they're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. When you are using the word come, it has to be totally, totally positive. Mm-hmm. Fun, happy. This has got to be the best thing this dog can do, mm-hmm. is to come to get a wonderful treat or some loving or come play with me, that kind of thing. And so when you're working with dogs, the verbal command is the human communication. The body language is the dog's readability. They're going to read your body before they listen to the word, even if they know the word.
How about the tone of voice?
Oh, absolutely. The tone of voice. I have a whole section in there on voice. Okay. And that's why when you're working with fearful animals, you never, ever want them to be surprised at your appearance in a room or when you walk around a corner. I talk about white noise humming. I kind of came up with that term because I hum a lot. I have terrible singing voices, everybody tells me, but my dogs don't care. But, you know, to hum, it's a displacement activity where it's not really making the dog pay attention to you, but they know where you are. They register what part of the house you're in, where you are. Are you going to suddenly appear and scare them like a stalker? If you're making noise, they're not going to think they're being stalked. And so you need to let them know where you're at. So I tell people hum. Mm-hmm. And this is especially efficient with horses, because horses need to, they have a lot of blind spots the way their eyes are on their heads. And when you're working around a horse, especially if you're behind it, you need to let that horse know where you're at. Yeah. And dogs are the same way. Cats are the same way. And you just need to always have some sort of non-threatening, pleasant, low-key sound that they can locate you, and also know what kind of tone you're using. And I have a whole chapter in the book, Beyond Flight or Fight, on how to use your voice for reward, for noise markers to make a behavior stop, how to redirect a behavior, how to then reward a behavior. Mm-hmm. People do a lot of talking about whistles and clickers. And, you know, sometimes you just don't have a whistle or a clicker. You always have your voice.
Right.
And so that's an important part of working with animals and learning to communicate, because people just chatter on and on and on and on, and dogs learn to ignore it unless a word pops up that they know.
Right.
And the word know, K-N-O-W, they will know many words, but that word, they don't have any idea the difference between that word that I know something, mm-hmm. and the word no don't do that. Mm-hmm. They'll pick out words that they understand, but not necessarily know the human differences, the meanings.
Differentiate.
That's why I tell everybody, just don't even use the word no.
Okay.
Because it doesn't have any meaning.
Right. Unless you, I would assume, only in that one context. But then if you fall back into the K-N-O-W, then it confuses the dog. All
exactly.
they hear is the sound itself.
Yeah, exactly.
It made me think, when I had my dog way back when, whenever I would get him to do something, I would say, please. Would you sit, please? Okay, you need to sit, please. Okay, and I would always say, please. And then I would think, why am I saying please to a dog? You know, I mean, it's a human psychological concept there. But what I start figuring out, I think, is that it put my voice and my demeanor in a certain place by using that word.
Yeah.
Now, he understood please only because I said that. But it was a, you know, like, okay, this is important now, you know, sort of thing there.
It does. It gets you. And I do that with my animals. I say thank you. It's a form of praise. Mm-hmm. It's a quiet form of praise. Thank you or please. They'll pick out the words that they know, and you have to teach them individual words like sit, down, mm-hmm. come. You teach those separately. But then when you add a praise word at the end, it could be thank you. It could be good dog. They're not going to care. Mm-hmm. It's the tone of the voice.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's, and by us using our own terms, we don't have to worry about necessarily our voice inflection, because when I say please, I'm already doing it. My voice is already
right.
in that mode.
It puts you in that mode, and it's mm-hmm. it brings you down. So you're not authoritative and going, sit, you know, and then the dog goes, oh my gosh, he's freaking out on me here, you know. So yeah, it just quiets you down, and the dog will pick out the word he knows.
Yeah.
And then he's going to pick up, please. These concepts are very abstract to a dog. Physical action is not abstract. Mm-hmm. But please, thank you, good dog. Those are abstracts. So that it has more to do with the tone.
Okay.
And if it calms you down to say it, mm-hmm. then your body language will automatically be softer. Your facial expressions will automatically be softer.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog will be looking at you and paying more attention to you in a non-fearful way.
Right.
And the reason I called it beyond flight or fight, Darwin coined the term fight or flight. And because dogs will either fight or flee, run away, they would much prefer to run away. Most dogs don't like to fight. So I flipped it and I call it beyond flight or fight. Because most dogs would rather run away from a fearful situation than fight their way out of it, although they will mm-hmm. if they have to. But basically being compassionate about fear and working with fear in dogs is why I wrote that book.
Okay, and it's something I picked up in when I read Flight or Fight about the escape route for a dog.
Right.
Is to allow that. Don't get them trapped.
Right.
Because then they are defensive and it's like, okay, my back's to the corner. There's nothing I could do but fight.
Right. And there, when you go from fearful to fear aggression, it can happen in a split second. And you can get very hurt. But you never want to put a dog into that position anyway. You don't want them to be that scared.
Yeah.
And so an escape route is really important, but it has to be controlled. You can't just let them run to Colorado Springs if they decide they're afraid of what's going on in your backyard. It's got to be a controlled type of fleeing where they can go to another room or they can remove themselves to go to their crate if they find their crate is a safe place, or if they need to run through a dog door and get out into a backyard that safely encloses them. So that they don't feel cornered, so they can come back then and investigate the feared stimulus.
Okay. When you, with your book now, The Dog at the Gate, you apply many of these principles, all of them, within the story itself.
Right.
So you model that through there.
Right.
I found it a delightful read, you know, Max. And he doesn't start off, you know, in a good note there in his life, that many puppies will endure. I mean, they get removed from their mom, you know, in 6 weeks or so. And, you know, many times it's a happy ending and there you are. But other times it's not.
Right.
It was really fascinating to have read the story of Max, and then having this background information that I learned from you, you know, by reading Beyond Flight or Fight.
Oh, well, thank you. That's great. Because the Beyond Flight or Fight, A Compassionate Guide for Working with Fearful Dogs, is an adult nonfiction. Very practical, down-to-earth, you know, steps on how to work with fearful animals. The Dog at the Gate, How a Throwaway Dog Becomes Special, is my middle grade fiction children's book about a dog. He narrates his own coming-of-age story. Because I felt that kids need to know that animals are not pieces of furniture. They're sentient, feeling, emotional beings. And if they could see the world through the dog's eyes as he explains it, and all his other animal character friends, then children are going to be more open to seeing them as friends.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major reasons I did that, as a professional human educator, I would teach classes for the Dumfriends League shelter and other organizations. And I'd have roomfuls of squirming, crazy kids. And I'd come out of there and I'd tell the teacher, I'd say, golly, Moses, I don't think they learned anything. And they'd go, oh, no, they were totally fascinated. And, of course, kids are always moving. So I got to thinking, you know, maybe they get one thing out of a class I teach in an hour. Okay, that's great. But how much more could they get if that humane education was given through storytelling, and it was in a book that they could go back to again and again? So I recalled my favorite books as a child that I still have and still reread, books like Black Beauty and Beautiful Joe. And Beauty was a horse and Joe was a dog. And then there was Thomasina, who was a cat. And these animals all told their own stories. And that's why they stuck with me. Because I was learning through the animal's voice. And I decided to do that with my story and have the dog tell his life story in his own way. So he starts off as a puppy. And he does not, as you said, have an easy start in life. And he tells his story through puppy language, through a child's voice. And then as he matures and he gets into his adolescence, he becomes very arrogant and tough. And he's had bad experiences, so he's decided he's going to be a mean dog. And that doesn't play out too well for him. He ends up in more trouble than not. So he has to make conscientious decisions, like children do as they come of age. What kind of grown-up am I going to really be? Do I want to go this route, or do I want to go that route? And what would be best for me and for the other animals that I am friends with? And so it's a lot about decision-making and helping kids come of age to understand the decision-making processes that go into, am I going to become a bully? Mm-hmm. Am I going to become a mean kid? Mm-hmm. Am I going to grow up and break the law? And so as this dog evolves into his maturity and his voice becomes more mature, he makes more responsible decisions. And, of course, at the end of the book, he's rewarded for the decisions that he has made in his life in a positive way. One of the main things I wanted to do with this book, too, especially aiming it at the middle grade, 8 to 14 range, is that when I was working with the cruelty investigators as a humane educator, we found that this is the age that children do not articulate their own frustrations and stresses. And they internalize them and they begin to act out. Some of that acting out can turn into animal abuse. Mm-hmm. Animal abuse always escalates to violence against people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted, A, for them to feel empathy towards this dog who's telling a story, but also to see that he makes decisions that turn him away from being a mean, aggressive dog. And they can make decisions like that too. And that there are rewards at the end of that decision-making process. So I'm hoping to reach kids at that age so that they develop more empathetic, cognitive understanding of all creatures in the world, that all creatures deserve respect and kindness and compassion, and to also encourage them to reach out to adults to help them through these difficult times. So I have got a few questions at the back of the book, but they lead to my website, www.sunnyweber.com, where I do have a discussion guide following up on Max's story, chapter by chapter questions for counselors, teachers, parents, and humane educators to reach out as trusted adults to engage these young children in conversations like, well, Max really had a tough time with this experience. Have you ever had that experience? Mm-hmm. How did you handle it? Did you have somebody in your corner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to begin that conversation so these kids can learn to process and learn to trust and learn to communicate with people that can guide them like adults, not their fellow naive peers.
Right. Yeah, and I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianica, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, here in the heart of the universe, the center of the universe, and that is Clear Creek County, Colorado, visiting here with Sunny Weber and talking about her works. I want to thank our community sponsors, and you know, without community sponsors, you know, like Tommy Knockers and the rest, community radio like this, not possible. I am bringing to you this portion of Writer's Talk, and you can learn more about my work, Sisyphus Wins, at jerryfabianic.com. Sunny, and we're talking about your work now, The Dog at the Gate. I was also impressed with the social interaction. You brought it up about the different animals in there, but how Max had to figure it out because he was all by himself in terms of his animal kingdom. He was it, other than the bully next door. So he had to deal with the bully next door, okay? And then he had, like, only the one human friend, I think it was, maybe two, the little kids there. And that dynamic, but then when he finally launches out into the larger world at the pound and then gets adopted and everything, and then learning how to interact with his peers also, and the type of characters they were, you know, or are in the story. And I can't remember the names of the dogs, you know, the older Australian Shepherd and, you know, like, and then the little, what was she, like a poodle that, you know, just let her, yeah, little Miss Pris over here. But, ooh, you know, I mean, it was just all the personalities came, but his interaction, you know, between the humans and the other dogs. And I'd like for you to talk about that a bit.
Well, Max starts off as a puppy who is bought from the breeders. He's separated from his mother and the kind people who raised him to the age of 8 weeks. And then he goes to a family with two young children, and it's not a very kind family. The one best friend he has is the little boy, this little toddler boy, they developed this very strong relationship. And what they had in common was they were both bossed around by everybody. And so the little boy was bossed by his parents, and the dog was bossed by the parents. The little girl kind of fades in and out. She's got her own concerns. She's not really that interested in him after the newness wears off, which happens with a lot of children. The parents would not allow the dog in the house. He had to stay out in the yard. They did give him a dog house with a bed, but he was all by himself, and he'd never been alone. And dogs are not emotionally equipped to be alone, period. And I tried to bring that out in the way Max saw his world and his fears at that time. The only friend he could possibly have, because he was in a fenced-in yard all alone all day long until the kids came home from school, was a blackbird named Snatch. And Snatch flew into the yard and introduced himself one day and said he'd been watching the puppy and that he wanted to get to know him. And that's the first time anyone had really shown any interest in Max. And so they became best friends. Well, Snatch was a very wise bird, and he'd seen a lot because he flew all around and he could see the world. And he'd come back and he would be a support system for Max in his loneliness and some of the abuse and neglect that he experienced in his backyard with his people. So finally, when he is taken away and dumped in a shelter, he has new dog friends that he's never had before in his life because he'd only known his siblings and his mother. Well, now he's introduced to dogs that are in the run with him or in runs next to him or up and down the aisles. So he has to learn how to communicate with other dogs. And this is where a lot of his decision-making comes in. Well, should I be a mean dog or should I be a nice dog? And then he loses his friends. One is adopted and one is euthanized because he's elderly and no one wants him. So Max becomes aware of the ways of the world in some very traumatic ways and some very positive ways. He's finally saved by Aussie Rescue because he's an Australian Shepherd. And he, as far as dog body language goes, that was one of the issues he had with his first roomie. She was a Boston Terrier, and she couldn't read his mood because people dock Aussie's tails. And he didn't have a tail to communicate, so she couldn't quite understand if he was a mean dog or if he wasn't. So he had explained to her that he decided he was not going to be a mean dog. So they developed a very close friendship, and he'd not ever had a close friendship with a dog before. But then she got adopted and left him. And when he was rescued by Aussie Rescue, he was put in a foster home with another Aussie named Miles and this little poodle mix, this very stuck-up, obnoxious, cantankerous, bossy.
Oh, she cracked me up.
And, of course, she wanted to rule the roost, yeah. And he decided that he'd be nice to her so that he could stay in the house. He wanted to stay with a family. But the family also had three cats, and he had only chased cats off the fence at his old house when he was a puppy. He didn't know anything about them. So Miles helps Max understand that these are animals like they are that deserve respect and kindness. And then he gets to know the cats, and he wants to be nice to everybody so that he can stay in this house and not be taken away to the shelter again.
Mm-hmm.
Or put in a backyard by himself again. Well, lo and behold, he finds this house is a dog door. So he never has to be alone in a yard again. He can go in the house anytime he wants, and it's one of the most joyous moments of his life.
Mm-hmm.
So then he has to learn to communicate with a human who really cares about him, who isn't mean, and who listens to him, which his first owners did not. And there's various little episodic experiences that, you know, while he tries to communicate and no one else is listening to him. So this mistress listens to him, and together they become quite a team. And she discovers that he's got ADHD for dogs. And that's why he kept getting rejected, because he was nuts. Nobody wanted to take him on. He was so hyper. But she finds that he has this work ability, this intelligence, and this will to learn. And she turns him into a champion obedience competitor. And they'll go all the way to the national competitions. And he's up against some very intelligent but snotty border collies.
I love it. I mean, all the human aspects of it here, you got it wrapped into the dogs there. It's hilarious. So at any rate, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So he goes and he learns that he does have talents and traits. His confidence is built. He bonds to the members of his family, and in various adventures, he saves them from dangers. He saves a little girl from drowning. He goes into a lot of different adventures. But through it all, he finds that he's slowly but surely winning over everybody in his family, including the stuck-up muffin.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just and we're going to leave because there's some really heart-wrenching stuff at the end there, but we don't want to ruin it for you. So I'm going to do a spoiler alert here, right? You know, so
well, yeah,
I don't know
but
how
it always ends extremely happily. Don't forget that.
There
are conflicts and there are issues that arise, but every animal goes through them and every person goes through them.
Right.
But what happens in the end is that he is rewarded for his decision making and for how he's handled the trials and tribulations in his life. And it is a very triumphant and happy ending that I think will help all children and people who love dogs of all ages. I'm hoping it'll become a classic like Beautiful Joe and Black Beauty, Thomasina, and all the other great, great books out there that go back to the classic stories of conflict and resolution and reward. And I told this based on the hero's journey storytelling model.
Right. Very much. Yes. I mean, this is Campbellian. Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
Is Luke Skywalker at a dog level.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
It's got a lot of very complex themes and a lot of messages for children as they grow up. And if this book can resonate with kids, that they want to reread it and reread it, and if they grow up to become behaviorists, trainers, conservationists, or any other profession that saves any animals' lives, then I'll be a really, really happy author.
Yeah. And you know, and that brings up another level there, Sunny. You know, to get little children connected with animals and their behaviors and, you know, how they respond to stimuli and, you know, and the pain and the suffering and the loneliness, and they deal with it as well. But you brought up about, you know, like the Campbell thing here and the hero's path. Mm-hmm. And to study that unto itself, just watching Max go through it. Because we all do that ourselves in some ways. So it's not only learning about that philosophical concept, but identifying with this character who happens to be four-legged and understand that animals go through it as well. And then it becomes like a bonding between us as humans, the two-legged ones and the other primates, I don't know. But, you know, those are pets is what it gets down to. It's just an intriguing story. I think you knock it out of the park here with it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I do. I wanted to make a lot of effort to help kids who need to learn through storytelling. There's a lot of kids that don't learn well with straight academics. And because this dog had a learning disability, we call it that, quote unquote, because he had ADHD, and he was rejected again and again. He was bullied again and again. He was treated cruelly again and again. Everybody thought he was stupid, and he wasn't. He was extremely intelligent. He just didn't know how to harness his energy until he had a guider in the form of the mistress who spotted his talents and his intelligence and showed him a way to funnel it into a constructive lifestyle. And that's what kids need. And to take a kid that's being pushed around or criticized and have them find a kindred soul in Max and to be able to identify with that and then see, hey, it turned out okay for him. It will for me too.
Yeah.
That was one of the very important messages I wanted to get across. And of course, to encourage kids to read, to read intelligent stories with fully blown characters that are very developed, that aren't violent, that aren't dystopian and dark.
Yes.
That this will engage kids not only with the animal world, and there's wild animals in this book too, so you learn more about
like
the environment. The
raccoon,
The raccoons and the prairie dogs and the coyotes. And so there's a lot of different components to the story that should grab and hold a kid's interest of both sexes, because girls will read animal stories till the cows come home, but I really wanted to capture boys as well.
Right.
And I think that teaching compassion and warm-heartedness and tolerance to boys is extremely important, especially in this day and age, and that the world doesn't revolve around guns and darkness and mystery and all the frightening aspects. If I was a kid today, I probably would not be reading.
Yeah. And it's great. And I'm envisioning another, maybe it's a more simplified version of Max's story, but maybe another one for, I'm going to say like kindergarten's first, second grade with the pictures in, the graphics. And then I'm thinking of our old friend Andrea with her book, Buster the Bully.
Right.
And I was thinking of The Dog Next Door and everything, too. Right. But just pulling out some of those themes there and put it in a pictorial thing. Because I envisioned, when I'm reading this, I am picturing the scenes of Max in his backyard and when he's at the pound.
Good.
And when he gets to go to his new home and everything and the door. And I visualize that, there. So the language is very vivid. But, to get something, at a lower level, reading level, if you will, and get them on so that then they can graduate into reading Max and the other stories, too.
I agree.
So,
I agree.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why I wrote this book, to also appeal to adults, because it's the adults that will read to the children.
Yes.
And children will learn to love reading because their parents read to them before they could read.
Right.
And that's another thing, to have that sharing moment and to build that trust between the parent and the child through reading.
Right. And that's a great idea, Sonny, is that maybe you have a 5 or 6 year old who not quite at this reading level, but they can hear the story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This is a bedtime story there. And it's a gripping one.
Well, good. I'm glad you thought so.
Yeah, it really is there too. So you have another work in the works.
I have two more actually. One is just gone into editing, and it's another adult nonfiction called Urban Dog Walking Safety and Etiquette.
Okay.
Because I live in the city and I walk my dogs an hour a day, and we come up against situations all the time that there is no dog walking book out there that will prepare you for a speeding bicyclist or a kid on a skateboard, if you have a fearful dog especially, but even if you don't. Even if you don't know exactly how someone's coming down the sidewalk directly at you with another dog and the dog shows signs of aggression, what do you do? Mm-hmm. If there's a stray dog in the park and you're walking and the dog comes up to you, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
When do you call animal control for help if you see an injured animal? I cover everything. The history of domestication with dogs, how we became partners, how far back it goes, how dogs became our partners, why they became their partners, and why they remain our partners. So I go through everything from the primitive days when we first domesticated dogs, and I bring the book all the way forward at the beginning, to the domestication of the dog, partnership with the dog in the rural setting like farms, working dogs, and then we get into the Victorian age where they became lap pets. Mm-hmm. And dog shows first started because Queen Victoria loved dogs, and the very pointed and specific controlled breeding to get the different breeds, the sizes, the shapes, the colors. And then through the Edwardian period, where the very wealthy people, you know, continued to keep dogs as pets, not working companions. And then, of course, I come forward into the Industrial Revolution and the age of information, and how people are isolated now, mm-hmm. with social media being their only contact many times with other people, and how lonely it is to work out of your home alone, and to have how important dogs have become as companions in today's world, in the urban environments that they're forced to live in. Mm-hmm. And what dogs need. I quote the great Professor Temple Grandin, who is a world-renowned animal behaviorist. And she has a wonderful book called Animals, many wonderful books on autism. She's an autistic Asperger's, brilliant woman in Fort Collins, teaches at Fort Collins at the University of Colorado, at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. And she has done a wonderful book called Animals Make Us Human. And she's got a chapter in there that I quote quite a bit about the seeking behavior to satisfy animals. What do animals need? What do dogs need in particular? Especially in a city life. And so often they're confined by fences and leashes, and you don't have many off-leash parks in a lot of areas. And how to satisfy their instinctive need for seeking behavior, as she calls it, to investigate their environment. Mm-hmm. We can't just walk them at heel mm-hmm. for 15 minutes a day and expect them to be satisfied and be cognitively stimulated and physically exercised. So I go into a lot of what these animals need, the research that she and others have done on how to make life with a human in the city satisfying and healthy.
Yeah, I like that. You know, animals make us human. Yeah, and
it's a great book.
Yeah, to bring out that human, because we lose that, and particularly in an urban environment where everything is helter-skelter, blah, 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 like this.
Right.
You know, and even in a suburban, you know, anymore, when you come home and hit the automatic garage door and you go in there and close it and, you know, and you lose yourself in your man cave, whatever it might be. But animals are pack animals. I mean, dogs are pack animals.
Right.
And they want to socialize, and they want to be with their other friends there too. And that's what so funny. We think of our, you know, differences as human beings, you know, skin color, races, that sort of thing. And then you look at all these different dogs, you know, and you got this little, you know, Cocker Spaniel, and then you got this Great Dane, and they're just over there, just like, they don't even realize it. They're just dogs. They don't, you know, I mean, maybe some are intimidated by size or something, but that's another thing. But they're just dogs. They're all frolicking around. I love it on your website where you have it up in the banner there in the masthead. And I don't know, there must be 30 different dogs there. And of course, I zeroed in on the chocolate lab.
Of course.
But, you know, and you just think it, all these, but they're dogs.
Yeah. Is what it is. And they have senses of smell that are 5,000 times more sensitive than ours. They have fantastic eyesight, most of them. Mm-hmm. They have great hearing. And they need to investigate. They need to be out there checking out the world. Mm-hmm. Confining them to a house or an apartment with no outside access, with no freedom to go check out, mm-hmm. you know, the trees or the shrubs or...
The fire hydrant.
The fire hydrant.
Where they all leave their right. calling cards.
Right, exactly, yeah. And they need to be able to do that to keep them healthy, both physically.
Right.
I go into a lot of things that can happen to a sedentary dog, what happens to their bodies versus an active dog. And the cognitive and emotional stimulation that they need as much as we do, because they're highly socialized animals, highly intelligent animals. That needs stimulation.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So if people want to get more information, get in contact with you, how do they do it? Your website, you mentioned it earlier,
right.
but let's go
right.
over and any events, that sort of stuff there.
Okay. And just one more thing, the dog walking book, we're hoping for a spring launch.
Okay.
It's in editing now. And then I'm in the middle of working on my next children's book as well.
Oh, wonderful.
And which will be another complicated turn of events, a very complicated plot, and again the dog tells the story. It's
okay.
a different dog in a different environment, and it's a completely different type of story. But that'll be coming. I'm not sure when, because that one's going to be a lot harder to write. But to get a hold of me, or if you have any questions about pet behavior, or you want to find my books, my website is www.sunnyweber.com. SunnyWeber. You can also go to www.thedogatthegate.com. There is a link to the landing page for this current book, this children's mm-hmm. book. A lot of testimonials on there from some really outstanding people. There's also a link from the main website. If you need information on Manners for Mutts and Kits, that's under one of the tabs on the main website homepage. And you can always email me through my website or through sunny@sunnyweber.com. Anything I can do to help you or your dog, I'd be more than happy to do.
Wow. And, you know, I not only thank you for making the trek here, you know, to talk about this, but and we've become very good friends over this, too.
Right.
It is exciting.
Right.
But, you know, all that you're doing here, you know, to not only our little, you know, four-legged furry friends and everything, but helping other human beings understand, you know,
right.
like when I'm out running or walking and there's that dog out there, I think of that, about giving them an escape route, that sort of thing there,
good.
You know, and avoid the immediately like stare down eye contact sort of thing there, just to kind of make your way. And, you know, so it's little stuff like that. And it really helps me. And I'm a dog lover, too. But every once in a while, you get in a situation, like you say, and then how do I handle this, too?
Right.
So
I'm trying to cover as much of the practical end of being a dog person. My books are not for professional dog trainers. They're for
mm-hmm.
you, the average person who loves a pet
mm-hmm.
and may find themselves in situations that they don't know or they have questions about or downright dangerous
yeah.
or downright happy. And why was this such a joyful walk today? I mean, what made this special? And, you know, and of course, my books are all on Amazon. And so you can certainly find, you can always find books, my books on Amazon as well as from my website. But the thing that you're saying that's so rewarding to me is that every little comment that you store away in your brain somewhere, that when you go out and you see a dog, something you learned from something I taught you that I learned from someone before me.
Right.
This is how we pay it forward.
Right.
And that's what it's all about, is learning, teaching, and doing.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's great stuff. And we have recorded this show, and I'll have it on my website. Okay, so if you didn't get to hear all of it, certainly just go to jerryfabianic.com, and it's under Writer's Talk.
Spell
under,
your last name, because it's so toughy.
You know, unlike Weber, right? That's a good point.
I said, wish you could do with mine is to put two B's in it.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's a Jerry with a J, and then Fabianic is F as in Frank, A, B as in boy, Y, A, N as in Nancy, I, C as in cat. And .com, and and our discussion a year ago is on there. We'll have this one up there, and we'll have your both books up there as well.
Great.
And more about you and everything too. So that's another resource. So if you miss part of this conversation, you go, hey, you know, I want to get more, you know, then certainly we'll have it there, and you know, you can go back and pick it up at your leisure, because it'll be like a podcast. You can listen to it whenever it works for you.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's always so great to see you.
Yeah, you too. And we'll be crossing paths. Are you going to be at the Denver Book Fest at the Denver Public Library?
I'm going to try.
Okay. That's March 3rd.
And I'm also going to be this Wednesday at the Lincoln Street Station, the pizza place down there off of Lincoln at the Lincoln Light Rail Station area. I will be one of three featured authors at Author Night. And there will be three children's authors. Andrea's going to be there, our friend Andrea.
Okay.
And we will have three children's authors there talking about our books, about the writing process, and doing readings. We will all have our books for sale and available for signings.
And so, where is that exactly? You say the Lincoln Station. Now, that's down on Lincoln Avenue, like Lone Tree area?
Lone Tree.
Yeah, okay.
Right, exactly. Lincoln Light Rail Station in Lone Tree.
Okay.
Right? The Lincoln Station Restaurant.
Right on. Okay. Oh, that's exciting. And it's just great stuff seeing all this unfold here too, you know.
So. It is. It's fun. And it's so fun to be able to expose the world to what's been in your head for so long and to help more animals and save more lives.
Right on. Okay. All right, everyone. Hey, this is Jerry Fabianic, KYGT, LPFM 102.7 and 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk, visiting here with Sunny Weber and talking about her works Beyond Flight or Fight, and also her latest work, The Dog at the Gate. And awesome discussion. And, you know, I think most of us out there in this audience are dog lovers and dog owners and daddies and mommies of dogs and stuff like this. But we always
bossed around by dogs.
And I get bossed around. My dog owned me. You know, you say about those fun walks. Yeah, well, when I got wrapped up, you know, when Knox went round and round and round chasing the squirrel, and, you know, and I was just tied up in a knot. It's like, how do I get out of this? It's fun stuff there. So, all right. I will be back in a couple of weeks, and we'll be talking more Writer's Talk. In the meantime, be safe, be kind, and let's just keep celebrating and enjoying life, eh? All right. Bye now.
Oh, thank you, Jerry.